from stpetecatalyst.com.
Joining me on Startup Report today is Tony DiBenedetto. Welcome, sir.
Hey, Joe.
Good to see you.
Glad to be here.
Thanks. So Startup Report is about spreading our early stage companies out there to the public. So a lot of folks who are, sold their company or want to invest and diversify might consider getting into looking at some early stage investments, whether through seed funders or Florida funders or with direct connection. And so the people who are watching kind of have an interest. And obviously, one of the best ways to get people comfortable with that is looking at successes, which you've had a good one. So I'd like to kind of dig into a little bit of the history of TriBridge and sort of walk through the sale process and then talk about your experience growing a tech company in the area.
Sure. I'm excited to talk about it and glad to be here.
Thanks.
Well, you want me to start a little bit with the planning process or even how we got funded? Start there and then
Let's start with the funding.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, me and Mike Kurtigan and Brian Deming had been meeting kind of while we were working at Arthur Andersen on a pretty regular basis and kept floating a bunch of ideas around like most entrepreneurs do. We had some crazy ones. We tried to buy a safe company, and I don't mean an electronic safe company. I mean a hard safe company in St. Pete, and that fell through. And then we looked at some land, and we were going to do a bar right next to Raymond James Stadium. And, you know, the funny thing about, you know, all these great ideas, we're sitting around and we're talking about the bar and we found the land we wanted. And then all of us were like, so who's going to work weekends? And that killed the deal. We all had little kids and we're like, yeah, none of us want to work on, you know, Friday and Saturday night. So that went on for a couple of years. And we finally built a business plan around CRM software for the middle market that was going to be on the internet. And that wasn't out yet.
It was still back in quotes back then.
Yeah, it was back in quotes and Salesforce wasn't around.
Yeah.
And so we put a business plan together and I, myself and Brian Deming met with Tom Wallace at, if you remember the old Malio's on Del Mabry.
Right.
And Malio's always had a kind of an interesting kind of dynamic. So you always felt like you were in this real connected place. Mm-hmm. And so you walk in and that's why I call Tom the godfather of technology, is that place reminds me of where there'd be a scene out of the Godfather, because Tom's already at the restaurant and he's sitting there. And I felt like Michael Corleone kind of walking into the restaurant, trying to ask him for money. And so we went and pitched him on this software idea. And Tom's like, hey, I don't know anything about those things. I believe in you guys. And he writes us a check for not the $3 million we were asking, the 300 grand we were asking for, and said, why don't you do what you guys know? Which at that point, we knew IT services. And so went back and built a business plan that eventually turned into TriBridge.
So there's a couple of interesting things there. So first, you had the three of you. What kind of bound you together? You know, you're looking at all over the place. You're looking at restaurants, you're looking at safe companies.
Sure.
So what was the sort of the glue that held you three together?
You know, it's funny because initially we were meeting because all of us like really enjoyed working with each other and we had super complementary skills. None of us, if you met the three of us, you're like, man, you three of you guys are completely different. But we knew we wanted to do something together and we had a long list of technology ideas.
Right.
So that was easy, right? It was easy for us to come out with the gym membership application and the, you name it. We were going to automate everything at the time. And we exhausted that list and said, man, that's super risky. Why don't we just start with a traditional business? That's how we got to the safe company
got it.
The other company. And so I think the bond was really trust. We had worked together for a long time. And we just thought philosophically, we were so complementary that the three of us would have made a good business. It turned out we were right, you know, that we did work well together. And obviously 20 years after that, we sold the company, but we just instinctively thought we had very, very good skills together.
And obviously Tom saw that too, because he was willing to just throw in and say, even didn't know
without
exactly
knowing the business.
What's gonna happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which speaks to the, you know, the chemistry and the presence you guys had as partners. So if, you know, when founders are thinking about starting companies, if you had to do it over again, what would be the things that you would look for in partners, and what are some of the, you know, the obviously complementary skill sets, but what are some of the other, you know, pluses and minuses that you look for?
Yeah, I think, just to comment on Tom first. To me, to this day, which I thank Tom, I think every time I see him, and I see him often, but to this day, I'm really amazed that he had such confidence in us that we didn't even have a business plan, but we had the money, which I know is not common and not real helpful to the audience because that doesn't happen a lot. But I would tell you that Tom knew me really well. They'd tried on a couple of occasions with me and Brian. to get us to join Waldeck, which is a company he had
right.
in the IT services space. So I think we went through that dance for 5 or 6 years. So we really,
okay.
there was a bond there. I do think the lesson out of that is the best place to ask for money is that more immediate circle of people that you build a relationship with, because they can trust you beyond the X's and O's. And I usually encourage people to go there. I think a lot of people do that. In terms of things to look for in partners, the thing that resonated and probably was a linchpin for us for growth was the culture of the company. And didn't know that going in. We didn't write a business plan saying we're gonna have a great culture. We didn't do that. But when we talked about getting together, when I say we had complementary skills, that was really about like business skills. The thing that wasn't different about us is the way we treated people, the way we thought about how we were gonna manage the company. And that turned out to be such a leverage point that I cannot tell you. For instance, the space that we were in had about a 30%, on average, about a 30% turnover ratio. Mm-hmm. We, on a typical year, were between 10 and 12%. Mm-hmm. So the money saved on that, the intellectual property that stayed in the company because we had a culture that people liked to stay in, really turned out to be a huge competitive weapon for us. And in a time, you know, over the 20 years we had the company, also, it was there was always a shortage of labor. And we never felt that. We always felt like because we had low turnover and because we could be attractive to new folks, so that bond around, you know, philosophy. So we spent a lot of time before we started the business talking through all kinds of scenarios. And it, again, it turned out to be culture. We didn't call it that, but we were talking about everything from how do we handle certain employee situations? What kind of benefits would we have? What was our real goal for doing the business? What was our mission? Like, and I always tell people that I'm talking to me, mission's almost like the religion of business, like the why we exist part. And I would say most startups, when I talk to them, the why usually sounds like, well, we want to make a lot of money or we want to own our own business. And that's usually not the why.
Right.
And so I wouldn't say force, but I try to encourage people to really think through like what's really motivating you. And the reason for that is there's lots of hard times in businesses. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to go through ups and downs and bad customer situations, bad money situations, whatever it is. And the fortitude to get through that is not a personality trait necessarily only. It's also, do you have this overall feeling that you need to get somewhere or do something? And that's that belief that turns into mission. When you have a mission that you're going to do these great things or whatever that is, it'll get you through the hard times because we're all going to have them. The question is, how do we react in that moment? And to me, the mission of the company usually dictates that. So when somebody doesn't really think through that, I always think in the back of my mind, huh, when bad times happen, how do I know if I'm going to invest money in this company, they're going to stick with it? Why are they doing this particular thing? If they can tell me some great story, true or not, that, hey, this is why I'm doing it. My grandfather was blank or, you know, I've always dreamt about this and it really motivates me, then I have a little bit more kind of enthusiasm for their passion for the business.
Got it.
If that makes sense.
And so when you talk about culture, it's hard. A lot of it's intangible, right? So you can set up a mission and then somehow there's a bit of magic that sort of binds everything together. Can you try at least to say what kept your turnover rate, if you know, specifically less than the competition in that space?
Yeah. For one, I'd like to define it, at least the way I would define the word culture in my words, because I do think it's more tangible than I think most people throw around.
Yeah.
So to me, the word culture is by definition for me, it's the way people behave in a company. Mm-hmm. So that's the simplest definition. Can be measured by all kinds of things. One, it can be measured by turnover. To me, the turnover number is relevant to the culture. Two, we did 360 surveys, whether our people were living to the culture, and we actually measured that. So we had a measurable number and a benchmark for people. We defined the behaviors. So we said, look, if we're going to say this, they can't just be words. So first we started with what we called guiding principles, and we had 5 of those, which I can tell you what those are if you want. And then second, we said, well, what does it mean to be a servant leader? Those are words. And so we said, well, here's what it means. So for each one of our guiding principles, we also had corresponding behaviors. And those got published and we trained on them, both as a leadership team, but also in the company. So now we had evidence. Well, this behavior means servant leadership. This behavior means teamwork. This behavior means honesty. This behavior means blank, entrepreneurship, which are 4 of the 5 I just named. Yeah. And so for us, it was those things. And I think the two that stood out for me when I look backwards and say, how did you keep such a talented team? It's not just keeping a team, right? How do you keep the best people and the most creative people? And for me, the entrepreneurship and the servant leader, those two came up the most. Mm-hmm. Maybe because they were more unique than the other ones. So when you think of entrepreneurship, I think of, do we want to take risks? Do we want to start new businesses inside of Tribeward? Do we want to start new practice areas? And we probably started almost 20 businesses inside of Tribeward. Mm. We didn't brag about that, but some worked, some didn't. I'd say probably 5 or 6 failed, and I think about 14 succeeded in kind of the Tribeward world. And most of them came from a team member. Mm. Most of the ideas didn't come from a boardroom, didn't come from research, came from somebody in the team saying, man, we keep hearing customers say this. Why are we not getting into this? And in the beginning, we'd be like, hey, write a business plan. Well, what's in the business plan? Well, these three things. Mm-hmm. Then over time, we did contests and we had vetting things. So we got more sophisticated, but frankly, some of the best ideas were just people in the market, us trusting them and saying, even if this doesn't work, you're not out of a job.
Right.
And so, and then we built a little methodology around, well, what does it mean to be successful with an idea? So we had a fast failure methodology, which mm-hmm. was mostly used in retail when you launched a new product. Mm-hmm. We took that and applied that to business ideas inside the company. And so we'd kill things pretty quickly if they didn't work. And things that did work, we put more money into and grew. So when people saw that in play, that, you know, let's just say of the 20 businesses we launched inside of Tribeward, 15, 17 came from the team. Mm-hmm. Then people got like, wow, I don't need to leave to start my own company. Mm-hmm. And I can do it here and become rewarded for it, et cetera. So I thought that was number one. The second one was servant leadership. And again, I couldn't even tell you, I couldn't spell that word probably 20 years ago. And we about our 7th or 8th year of business, one of my guys, the guy that ran our Dallas office, I was visiting him in Dallas and he gave me this book by James Hunter. It's called The Servant. And he looks at me and he goes, man, I read this book. I thought of you. I think you should read it. I'm like, oh, okay, great. Don't know anything about this. And get on the plane. It's a quick read. I read it in 2 hours on the way back. And I said, holy cow, this is our company. This way of thinking is our company. Told the whole management team, listen, I never mandated anything, but man, read this book. If you don't believe in this, quit. Mm-hmm. Because this is who we're going to be. And we're gonna rally behind this concept. And the couple of concepts I would say is, one, there's no power in a company. It's all about, you know, earning people's respect and serving them. Mm-hmm. So as a leader, one of the chapters in the book shows an organizational chart and the CEO's at the bottom of the chart, serving the management team, who's serving the mid-management, who's serving the consultants, who's serving the customers. And if people didn't act in that way, and there's lots of ways to define that way, then we fired them or told them, hey, you're just not a fit here.
Right.
And that showed up, man. I will tell you, we had 4,000 customers at Tribeward, which is a lot, and they were global. And any visit I had, almost the number one or the number two thing was either you have great people or your people look at our business like your business. And both of those came from both servant leadership and entrepreneurship. So it was kind of easy after that point to say, how do we define it with the guiding principles? How do we measure it with these behaviors and these 360s? And then let's just keep attracting those people. And what happens is people start saying, well, I know somebody in the industry. And then all of a sudden you get more people that are alike like
right,
that.
Right.
And it really caught fire in the company.
So you made an interesting observation about how you're letting entrepreneurship flourish within the company, kept people from going on and sure. doing it. So structurally, how did that, when people came with ideas and they started and you know you had them grow those ideas, what was sort of their stake in it? Were any of them set up as separate entities or was there a rev share or how did you reward them or how did they participate?
It was all different things. So sometimes people had an idea and they just wanted to throw it over the transom and then we took it and ran with it and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. In that case, there were some cash bonuses and stuff that were pretty small. But we had a couple of people, and I can give a couple of examples where we did exactly what you're saying. So we had a guy on our team, Greg Pierce, who ran our infrastructure practice. And for about 18 months, man, he was just on me. He's like, man, we've got to do this virtual private cloud thing. I'm like, what the hell is a virtual private cloud? And he kept saying it over and over again. And then he did some research. And then, you know, Amazon was just putting something out. So it was a real techie product at the time. And then Microsoft was doing something called, like, I think it was BPOS or something like that. So it's pre-Azure. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, I've looked at these things. I don't think they're for us. I don't think our clients are going to get out of it. But what it'll give us is it'll give us a normalized infrastructure because we had an infrastructure practice. And he's like, every place we go, the infrastructure is different, which makes it really hard
right.
to keep them up all the time. But if we had the same infrastructure and we controlled it on a mass basis, you know, we can give this consistent kind of uptime and experience level and our clients will be a lot happier. And finally, I was like, at the same time that LLR was investing in our company, I said, listen, write up a business plan. And he did. We'll pitch it at the very first board meeting. So the very first board meeting we have, we pitch it to LLR and they go, we hate it. You're not in that space. We don't understand that space. And it was a $750,000 ask. It was a big ask for the size company we were at the time. And so that's what the board said. So I left the meeting and I said, Greg, listen, board shot it down. Do it anyway. You're not getting 750. Just start it.
Yeah.
And we'll prove to them it was a good idea by showing them the customers. And then they'll pour all the money into it and we'll upgrade it to version two. And version one wasn't great.
Mm-hmm.
Version two was great. And we launched that business in 11. And in about a 6 or 7 year period, it grew to 35 million. Very quickly, it had its own legal entity. Greg was rewarded with lots of things like more responsibility, which is not necessarily a gift. He did get some equity in the firm. We did start another business that he ran. He did get bigger bonuses. And I think it all did work for him.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing to him, I would tell you, is he tells everybody, and I tell everybody, he was the entrepreneur that launched Concerto for Tribridge. And so he, the rest of his life, knows that he started a business that's still around. It's in now the DXC family now. And he's still with DXC. So he was the founder and creator of that business. And everybody in our company knew that.
Yeah.
So he got the whole experience, I think. You know, he didn't have to suffer through, well, he even suffered through the money thing, right? He wanted more money. And we're like, no, you can't have more money because we can't give you more money. So it really was the full journey. And we had other people like that. So two of our software products that we launched in the marketplace were like that as well. Again, that wasn't something we publicized a lot in the newspaper or anything, but inside it really kept people excited. Like, hey, I want to be like Greg. I want to be like Damon, who was another guy that did something similar. So
with three partners, obviously as businesses grow, there's, you know, different stages, their startup stage, mid-growth, and
sure,
you know, the big bureaucracy that everything ends up being a lot of times. How did you sort of load balance, you know, the work as people sort of ebbed and flowed and whatnot, and then, you know, and stay connected in that way as partners?
Yeah, to me, it's one of the keys to success is quickly both being honest with your partners about what everybody has to bring to the table, mm-hmm. and B, not having meetings on every single topic, every single day that's, we don't need three people to talk about. So a couple of things. In the very beginning, because of our very complementary skill sets, you know, it was easy for me to take sales and strategy and recruiting because they all were related to my skill set.
Mm-hmm.
It was easy for Brian, who was the most buttoned up guy we had on the team, to take all the back office functions, including still doing some consulting. And Mike was super technical, so he took the technical side. So when I said we had complementary skill sets in the beginning, we had really complementary skill sets.
Right.
There really wasn't overlap. However, you know, like you're suggesting, or like I'm suggesting, the three of us still got together for the dumbest things.
Right.
And so I always tell people the turning point in the company was about 18 months in, and I call it the water cooler incident. And we had this big meeting. In fact, it wasn't even 18 months. It was probably a year in. We had this big meeting. It's 2:00. And at that time, we didn't even have desks yet. We just had a couple tables in the middle of the office space. And we're having a meeting about water. And I'm not kidding, water. 2 hours. And we were deciding whether we wanted bottled water, we wanted a service, were people going to pay for it? Were we going to put a filter on? And this went on for 2 hours. And it hit me exactly like it should have hit me. I was like, guys, I never want to be involved in this again.
Right.
And they agreed. I'm like, listen, if Brian's in charge of these things, unless Brian thinks we need other people in the meeting,
mm-hmm.
he's going to call that. Same thing with me. Like, yeah, strategy, of course, we're all going to work on together. But if we're on a sales pursuit or like, we're not going to come back and talk about sales. We'll do our normal meetings, but we're not going to have meetings about every aspect of what I do or you do or whatever.
Right.
And I think that allowed us to grow really quick. Our first year, we did $2 million in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because we divided the work.
Right.
And then from that point on, we never turned back. I think it's a mistake to do partnerships. That's going to be a weird thing to say. And I mean partnerships in context of we're just partners and we both have skills that overlap and we're not going to have a clear kind of lane to work in. I think it's much better to have more titles that give you, could be some overlap, because obviously in startup mode, you got to do a bunch of stuff. But we did a good job of task assignment inside those roles that when we needed each other, we needed each other, but 80% of the time or 90% of the time, we were running. So you have three pretty competent guys going out and getting stuff done. And it allowed us to scale really quick.
Yeah. And I think that's the water thing is a great observation in that that sort of doesn't exist if you don't have 3 liters, right? Because right. you're just not sure. And so then the question is, how early do you define that? How early do you say, you know, you got up to X number of months into the company and said, at this point, 3 of us don't need to be here.
Sure.
But it had gotten to a point where, you know, that's water is a, you know, a small thing and you're still doing it. So obviously there's probably a lot of things like that before that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't the first time I was frustrated with it. So.
Yeah. So, you know, as early as you can, and I think overlap is probably one of the biggest breeders of discontent in partnerships is when people both want to do the same thing.
I agree.
So role setting early as you can, would you agree is important?
I would say if you have a founder that has no partners and is bringing in new partners, I'd say before they even join the company, I would do it. A lot of times founders start together. And if they start together, I would say as early as it's possible. There's no question there's a certain amount of both energy and things to do in startup mode where you almost don't want any definition because you really just got to get a lot of stuff done.
Right.
And it depends on the size of the company, the scope of the company. I think that's a few months
right.
for most companies. Now, it could be longer if the company has other things going on. I think it's a few months. But I think after that, again, it can change year to year. Like I don't want to give you the impression that what was in my circle and Brian's circle and Mike's circle didn't change a lot. It did, but it changed in a more formal way. Like we'd get to the end of the year and said, okay, we're going to look at the org chart. And the org chart was our way and we never published it. Mm-hmm. So we had an org chart that never got published the whole 20 years.
Right.
I don't think we ever published an org chart in the company. And so, because we just didn't believe in that. We just believed in roles. And so that's a whole nother dialogue for another day. But every year we talked about what's your area of responsibility. And I thought that was super helpful for us. So I do think the earlier the better. I think you're spot on that. And it's something I do tell entrepreneurs, whether I'm coaching them through the wave, whether I'm making investments, is who's in charge of what? What's their sphere of influence? How are we collaborating? How are we getting updates? How are we measuring? All of those things, working through those. I will tell you, we did have an advantage in that the three of us worked in a large international consulting firm where a lot of those best practices we had access to. And we worked with a lot of entrepreneurs, some of which that did that and some of which that didn't do that because we worked in the middle market practice. Mm-hmm. And so that gave us a lot of access by the time we started our company. Now, it's funny. I thought it took me a long time to start the company. I was 32. And now I think a 32 is so young. but by the time I was 32, you know, I had a lot of experience with those companies. So I felt like I knew what I was doing, even though technically I had not started. I had started other companies that I certainly invested in and all that, but I wasn't full-time an entrepreneur in those other companies until we did TriBridge.
Wonderful. And I mentioned at the beginning of the show that a lot of this, the pitch list was sort of created to get potential investors. And so I kind of want to explore the Tom Wallace relationship a little bit. Obviously, sure. He's a unique character
sure.
in how he operated. You know, now you're sort of into that spot where you're going to be that for somebody eventually and, sure. and through the work you do with the wave. So, you know, let's talk about the different ways, both healthy and unhealthy that investors and mentors interact with young companies.
Sure. Sure. For one, I have been investing in companies for 20 years. So, I do enjoy that. And, you learn a lot from what other people do with you like that. So, I think my experience with Tom is unique and don't think you should wait for that to happen. So, but I do think it was grounded in that I built a really good relationship with him. And so it didn't happen by accident. It wasn't just, oh, Tom was bored and he wrote a check to me. He was following me for about 6 years. We were interacting on a bunch of other stuff. And then eventually that just was the one and it worked. I think Tom is pretty thorough in his research on people and also ideas. And I don't think he does that willy-nilly. And so I would say, you know, for me, there's a couple things. Like when somebody comes to kind of pitch me on an idea, I want to make sure that I can both understand the business, but also can add some value beyond the money. Because no matter what money they're asking for, they're going to need a lot of things, right, in the startup phase. And so, like, for instance, healthcare is a place where either people assume I have experience or not, which I have a little, but I usually say no to healthcare ideas because I don't feel like I bring a lot to the table, whether that's my network or my knowledge. I mean, it's a very unique. And I'm saying healthcare broadly, obviously there's niches in healthcare, which I do have a little experience, but for the most part, I don't invest there. But so I look for, you know, a place where I can add value beyond the money because it's leverage, right? Second, you know, you do your research on the person or the team that's pitching. And everybody says that you bet on the jockey and not the horse or whatever the metaphor is. I probably mix that up, but, and I believe in that. I think you learn from experience with somebody, how they're going to react. And I recently experienced that where, you know, some of my investments, like I thought I knew the person, and then over time it looks like they're different character wise and all that. And others I'm slow on, you know, one that I was slow on at first, but I feel really good about now is My Area Network. Like, it took me a while to invest because I took my time to get to know Scott. Mm-hmm. And now, like, I see it all. Like, I can see him and I go, this guy is going to be successful. I hope it's with My Area Network. It could be with something else, but I can see the way he thinks. And I've worked with him in a coaching role for a little over a year before investing. So I got this experience where I can go, oh, I see that this, not just the idea is good, it's him. I can see the way he treats people. I see the way he thinks. I see his decision-making. I want to bet on that. And the idea, you know, whether it works or not, I don't know, but he might change it 50 times. So it's, you know, an early stage company. So for me, really vetting that out, the lesson I've learned from kind of those two, you know, juxtaposing those two together and saying, which one did I like and which one I didn't, I think I'm going to take my time going forward instead of, you know, somebody thinks it's a good idea, they introduce you, mm-hmm. 2 meetings later, you write a check. That's not probably my personality after going through what I've done recently. Most of the investments I've done, I feel like I've known the founder really well. So therefore, they've mostly worked. Like, I've gotten good returns from those investments. And so one piece of advice and one thing I've noticed is just really working that pitch, really practicing the pitch, knowing what things to say and not say. Don't over-exaggerate. Like, one thing drives investors crazy, certainly drives me crazy, is where somebody talks like they have a $3 million revenue run rate, and then they send you the financials, they're doing $20,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And I've had that, those exact numbers just about presented to me. So that to me is a big no-no. You know, I've had people at times tell other people that I was investing in their company when I wasn't. Mm. And we all talk. Tampa is a smaller community. Tampa Bay is a smaller community. And, you know, quickly somebody will call me and say, did you invest in this company? I'm like, no, I talked to the guy a couple of times, but probably not even writing a check.
Right.
And so then, of course, they think the person's lying to them because they are. And yeah. So the whole talking straight thing, it's one thing to be an optimist. It's another thing to outright, you know, not tell the truth. So I think that interaction's interesting. I think showing your passion, like, don't be afraid to kind of let your passion flag fly, if that's a term. It probably isn't. I get turned on by that. I really get turned on by somebody's passion. So if I believe that they believe in something, that just goes a long way with me. I don't know if it does other investors, but I love passion for businesses. One thing I think I've at least learned or feel good about, like, a couple of investments I've gotten out of recently were with second time. And I don't mean just second time entrepreneurs, people that were in their discipline, either they worked for somebody or had their own company. And this was then the next generation of that.
Right.
Man, that has worked now for me twice, where those investments have gone really well. They know the space coldly. They've done it before. It's a little bit easier to write a check to somebody. Like, me trying to do the safe company, or Brian and Mike and I doing the safe company or the restaurant, the investors probably looked at us and like, what the hell are you talking about? Why am I going to write a check to you? You're an idiot.
Yeah.
I think the reason Tom was comfortable writing the check, going back to comfort, is he said, don't do the software company, which you don't know. Do what you know. And so we built TriBridge's first business plan around all services we had done for 10 years at Arthur Andersen. And so finally, it's taken me a long time, but that's worked for my investment strategy as well. So I don't know if that covers all the thoughts.
That's great information. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Sure.
Wonderful. And I want to finish by giving you a couple of minutes to talk about Think Big for Kids. It's a great program, and I want to make sure it gets some airtime.
Sure. You know, one thing I think that is part of being in the tech ecosystem, mm-hmm. if you go back to Bill Gates and others, is tech people giving back to the community. And so Tampa Bay is no different than that. And so I love that, you know, we've started a few years ago an organization called Think Big for Kids, and it's helping kids in poverty kind of navigate their career journey from sixth grade to their first job. And we help them with first figuring out what careers are even on their roadmap, to mentoring, to actually getting an internship, to going to school or not, and then getting their first job. And we're currently serving about 750 kids in the Bay Area, and it's growing rapidly. So thanks for the 2 minute plug on that.
Yeah, no worries. And thanks for your time. It's always fun to catch up and enjoy the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
From stpetecatalyst.com. Radio. St. Pete.